here. So I will speak about relative locality today. What is it? It's basically a way to make sense of having a curved momentum space, or a momentum space which is not a linear manifold like a vector space. So a number of people have considered curved momentum space over time, and mainly it was motivated with quantum gravity and research in that field. So the motivation I will give you for having a curved momentum space comes from Born's reciprocity principle. This principle postulates that there is a fundamental symmetry between coordinates and momenta in quantum mechanics. Now, you can see that in general relativity breaks this symmetry, as it treats very differently the space-time and momentum space. Space-time can be curved, is a manifold, a Riemannian manifold in general relativity, while momentum space is a vector space, which is the tangent space to space-time. So for example, the phase space of a particle propagating over a curved space-time is a cotangent bundle of space-time. Now, if Born reciprocity principle is respected by quantum gravity, maybe there is a dual theory to general relativity which recovers this reciprocity. So this is also suggested by the fact that general relativity may be thought of as the h bar goes to zero, the classical limit of quantum gravity. And this limit is taken this way, since you have also the Planck mass as a constant in quantum gravity, you have to keep the Newton's constant fixed to take this limit. You might think of it as the limit and Planck goes to zero of quantum gravity. Now, what happened? Now, Now, I was saying another natural limit, natural classical limit, non-quantum limit from quantum gravity, is sending M Planck, sending g to zero and keeping M Planck constant. In this way, you see that even in this way, h bar goes to zero. So the theory we would obtain would be dual to general relativity, in the sense that momentum space would be allowed to be curved, and space-time would be the cotangent band manifold, cotangent space to the momentum space. And the phase space of a particle would be the cotangent bundle of momentum space. Also, notice that the Planck mass in this theory would play a role that is analogous to g, but for momentum space, because it has exactly the squared of a Planck mass has exactly the correct dimensions to play the same role as g. This is a new approach that started less than 1 year ago by these guys here. And now, what's the ontology of this theory? What are the fundamental constituents of it? What are the objects we have to work with? Now, consider this. Space-time and length are not the things that we measure more directly. Our picture of space-time as a manifold is an inference that comes from a measurement which more fundamentally are measurement of momentum space. For example, what you see, the pictures that your brain elaborate, come from measurement of colors of of angles between light rays that hit your eyes. These guys live naturally in momentum space. They are the energies of the photons that hit your eyes and the angles between the three momenta of these photons. Now, look at this. This picture is a pinhole camera image of the sun. Now, a pinhole camera, if you don't know that, is basically a dark room in which you have a hole, a very small hole on one of the walls. And then if there is sufficient luminosity on the outside, an image of the outside world gets projected on the opposite wall. And from this image, we can deduce a lot of geometric information about the sun, for example, its shape or the fact that it has spots on it, and so on. But what if the image you got from the pinhole camera was this. This is what you get if you put a prism in front of the pinhole. Now, light rays of different colors come out from the prism with different angles. And now you get this mess. The geometric information is encoded in a very non-trivial way in this image. So making statements like the sun is round or detect spots is difficult here. Where are the spots? Now, the space-time picture, the geometric picture that we infer, is something that we can do because we have it is an approximation that we can make because of a fact. The fact that the world that we see filtered at every color is basically the same. The image that you get filtering at different colors, the photons that your eyes receive, coincide. Now, relative locality postulates that at high energy, essentially the world looks more like this, because we have no evidence that this approximation can be valid at all energies. There might be sufficiently hard photons for which the space-time we want to reconstruct would look more like this. Now, a basic principle in relative locality is to work with geometric quantities, with intrinsic geometric properties of momentum space. So that basically in the theory we want the theory to be invariant under diffeomorphisms of the momentum space. So there is in the original paper you can read that with the measurement performed over a series of single particle systems, we can reconstruct the metric properties of momentum space. For example, this one, this relation here, this is the geodesic distance of a point in momentum space from the origin of momentum space. This is related to the mass of the particle. This is the generalization of the dispersion relation of special relativity. Special relativity is the flat case. In relative locality, it's treated as a flat momentum space. In the flat momentum space, this guy here is just the square of the energy minus the square of the momentum. So this law is generalized to a law that depends only on intrinsic quantities. This is diffeo invariant. Now we can reconstruct all of the informations about the metric through measurements of mass of particles and of kinetic energy. Kinetic energies of a single particle is related to the geodesic distance of the point in momentum space representing the momentum of this particle from another point which represents the momentum of a particle with the same mass that is at rest. If you make this calculation in special relativity, again, you get 2 times m times the kinetic energy of the particle. And this is all about the metric information you can get from experiments about the momentum space. But then there might also be a connection of momentum space. And this has been related to a system of interacting particles. So consider this. You have the scattering of a particle, of a hard particle with a momentum p, and an ultra-soft particle whose momentum is infinitesimal, is dq. Now, in a curved momentum space, an infinitesimal momentum means that it is infinitesimally close to the origin of momentum space. Since it's infinitesimal, I can approximate very well this point of momentum space with the vector and the tangent, or better, the cotangent space to the origin of this manifold. Then, a natural thing to do is parallel transport this vector to the tangent space at P, at the momentum of the hard particle, and then I get UdQ, which is a parallelly transported vector. Again, this vector is infinitesimal, it's at an infinitesimal distance from the origin, from P. So I can approximate it with a point on momentum space, P prime. Now P prime is the scattered momentum, the momentum after the scattering of the hard particle on the soft particle. Now, as you know, the parallel transport is path dependent. We want a law that is diffeo invariant, that is intrinsic. So we have to choose a path, and the natural choice is to choose the geodesic connecting the origin with the point P. Now, to generalize, so the formula would be this. And to generalize this to two finite momenta, we have to we can do the following. We can connect the momentum Q to the origin with another geodesic, then split it into a series of small segments, and perform the same procedure over all of them in order. Then what we end up is a law connect, relating couples of geodesics to a third geodesic. This equation, as you know, if I take both momenta infinitesimal, reduces to the parallel transport reduces to the connection calculated in the tangent space at the origin. So, sorry, calculated at the origin of the momentum space. So this rule, which basically is the composition law or the conservation law in particle processes, is controlled by the connection of momentum space. Now, in general, we can introduce abstractly a binary relation between points on momentum space that associate two points, a third point with two original points, and we can assume that it has a possibly bilateral inverse. And from the definition I gave you before, you can see that the algebraic properties of this rule are related with geometric properties of momentum space. For example, the non-commutativity of the rule is related to the torsion of momentum space. And the non-associativity is related to the curvature of this connection. Now, equipped with these weapons, with these tools, which are geometric and diffeo covariant, we can introduce dynamics, basically. Now, for a free particle, since we are working in the phase space is the cotangent bundle to momentum space, it's natural to use this. This is the this Lagrangian is the Legendre transform of an Hamiltonian, which is a pure constraint, and is a Lagrange multiplier. It's a Legendre transform is performed in the opposite way. You know, the derivative is put on the momentum, not on the coordinate. And so X would belong to the cotangent space to momentum space. Now, from the variation of the Lagrange multiplier, you get this constraint, which is basically a non-shell relation, so a dispersion relation. And from the equations of motion, you get that the momentum is conserved because it's a free particle. And the coordinates, we're working in four dimensions. Is a line, a straight line, the word line of this particle in an inferred space-time. And the angular coefficient of this line is determined by the momenta and doesn't enter because it multiplies all of the four components of X. So the angles would only be determined by the ratio between the P's. Now, interactions, we have to introduce them. Of course, I didn't mention that everything here is different invariant. This is a covector multiplied by a vector because it is the derivative. And this guy is the distance, which is an intrinsic geometric object. And moreover, this is a parametrization invariant theory. So S, this parameter here, is non-physical. It just parametrized the points on the word line. To introduce interactions, I have to enforce a conservation law of momentum, which is, again, geometrical. So I have just to use only this operator here, this O plus, and I have a number of particles with their momenta, and then to compose them only with O plus and O minus, its inverse. So this large K is our conservation law in a vertex. This conservation law lives only in a single point of the word lines of the particles. So I can choose my parameter S to have the value S0, which is purely conventional at this point, for every particle. Then the conservation law is enforced by this Lagrange multiplier, Z, which leaves, and kappa leaves only at the value S0 of S. In the free action also, I can choose to label the wavelengths of incoming particle, in this example, with the values of s that are smaller than s0, and outgoing particles with values of s that are greater than s0. In this way, I gain a boundary term in the equations of motion, which come from the integration by part of p dot. And this term enters the variation of, well, it mixes with the variation of the interaction action with this term here. And what I get is this equation. Now, to understand what this means, you can think about special relativity again, the flat case. In the flat case, all O plus goes to go to an ordinary sum plus, and all O minus goes to minus. So this guy here, kappa, is linear in the momenta, so its derivative is a constant. And what you get here, the calculation, is that the value, the coordinates of word lines at the value of the parameter s0 are all equal to z. So z is the represent the coordinates of the interaction point. And there is locality. So the interaction looks local. There's a single point at which the wavelengths of the particle meet. Now, in the general case, when k is nonlinear and it's a complicated expression, what I get is something like this. Here I represented a particular solution of this system. You see that the wavelengths of different particles stem out from different points. They don't coincide with z. But now there is an interesting thing. Look at the equation. It's linear in z. So if I choose a smaller z, also for the same solution, also the non-locality, the difference of the point at which the particles stem out from z are reduced by the same amount. And ultimately, when I take z equals to 0, they all coincide. What's the interpretation of this? This is what we mean with relative locality. The coordinate system I showed you can be thought of as the space-time inferred by an observer which sits at the origin of this coordinate system. So when a process takes place near to the origin, it looks local. Just look local, like in the ordinary special relativity. But when it's far away, it can look very non-local. But now, this is somewhat contrary to the usual intuition about quantum gravity and Planck scale effects. You expect to find them at the very small. Here, the farther you are, the larger effect you get. Now, this non-locality, of course, is not physical, because this relation here, this is a covector. And so it's, and z is just a Lagrange multiplier. This guy is not diffeo invariant. If I change the coordinate system of momentum space, the way in which the non locality is realized changes. So it is not a physical non locality. Moreover, it depends on the observer, because as you see, local observer will always see non-locality, will always see non-locality. And faraway observer will see different amounts of non-locality. This is much like simultaneity in special relativity, which becomes relative to the observer. It's not an absolute concept. Now, what is physical, by the way, is not the amount of non-locality, but it's the fact that the word line crosses the origin. This is something that is diffeo invariant, because word lines are covectors, so they have a linear structure. They transform in this way under diffeomorphisms of momentum space. So if x is zero for some s, it keeps being zero at every coordinate system of momentum space. Now, this is the basics about relative locality. I can give you a brief account of the present status of research on that, which is not complete at all, but just to give you an idea. There is both research on phenomenology associated with this theory and on theoretical issues. Now, phenomenology, it's interesting that this theory provides a prediction, which is measurable, and it provides several predictions which should be measurable. But one in particular, the one regarding gamma ray bursts, is being bounded, it's been tested already now with the Planck scale at the level of something like 2 times the Planck mass. They're looking at the Fermi Space Telescope at gamma rays from gamma ray bursts that take place very far away from at cosmological distances. And they look at the time of arrival of these photons, if there is a delay between the low energy and high energy components of this spectrum of photons, this would be a manifestation of the non-metricity of momentum space. So they're bounding non-metricity at the Planck level, that's it. Then other effects which might be measurable have been proposed, like this dual gravitational lensing, which went well on. I'm particularly interested in this aspect, which is that in the original paper by Amenio Camelia, Fedella, and Kowalski, Glickman, and Smolin, they argued that atom interferometers might bound the torsion of momentum space with a meaningful sensitivity. I worked on atom interferometers for particularly on their relevance for quantum gravity. So this is something that I would take in mind, because I think there is space for these experiments to give meaningful bounds. Okay. Now, that's it for phenomenology. On theoretical issues, there is a lot has been done, and there is even more to be done. But in particular, I will remark the fact that there has been a lot of attention to the issue of translational invariance in relative locality, because it's really at the core of the novelty of this theory. You know, you can, if there is translational invariance, you can relate observers which are local to a process with observers which are far away. So the novelty is surely there. And Lorentz invariance was somewhat forget because the expectation was simply that if momentum space possesses a symmetry or like a group of symmetries, like isometries of the De Sitter or Minkowski space, then you would have simply a symmetry of the action, and then Lorentz invariance would be realized in the physical model. Now, this is something that I studied, because there is novelty also there. It's not trivial at all. And I will show that first in this, speaking about this work I did in collaboration with Giulia Gubitosi, which is the application of, we studied the relation with between quantum groups and relative locality. And in particular, we found novelty in the way in which Lorentz symmetry is realized. And then if I have time, it depends on how long it takes, I will speak about another work I did with the people in Saragozza on the still on Lorentz invariance. Now, the first thing I will speak about is this connection between relative locality and quantum groups, and in particular Kappa Poincaré, which is a well-known quantum group which has been studied a lot in quantum gravity. This work was been done in collaboration with Giulia Gubitosi from Berkeley. First of all, let me introduce you a bit what a quantum group is. It's a generalization of Lie groups that are so useful in physics that hopes to describe the symmetries of a non-commutative space. Now, a quantum group is technically an Hopf algebra. It has, in addition to the product of an algebra that every algebra has, it has additional structure, which are these three maps, which altogether I will call it co-algebra. It's a co-algebraic sector of an Hopf algebra. These three maps are a co-product, which is a map from the group to the direct product of two copies of the group. Then an antipode, which is a map from the group to itself, and the co-unit, which is a map from the group to numbers, to complex numbers, if you want. So to understand a bit what it means, I can show you how you codify the structure of an ordinary Lie group into an Hopf algebra. because they are generalizations of Lie groups, so they can, of course, describe the classical case. Now, as algebra, you take the algebra functions of the Lie group. This is an abelian algebra, because as product, you take the pointwise product of functions. Now, all the structures of the group are codified into the coalgebra. The coproduct codifies the group rule, as it is a map from functions to functions over two variables, essentially. So the coproduct of f is a function of two group elements, whose value is f, the original function, calculated at the product of g1 and g2. Then, it's natural, antipode codifies the inverse in this way, and co-unit codifies the identity element, as it calculates the function over the identity element. So in this way, you have all the structures of the group, and you can codify every group in this language. Now, these guys are interesting for non-commutative geometry, because the algebra, which here I took abelian, because it was the product was the pointwise product between function, can be generalized to a non-commutative algebra. In that case, it is common wisdom that the algebra might describe the symmetries of a non-commutative space. And I will also show you how. First of all, let me give you an example of the quantum group I'm interested in too, which is Kappa Poincaré, which is a non-trivial example, non-commutative example. The coalgebraic structures are the same as the Poincaré group in algebra terms, but then the translation generators and Lorentz group elements get non-commutative, and the non-commutativity is controlled by this kappa, which is a dimensionful parameter with the dimensions of a mass. When it goes to zero, the non-commutativity disappears, and this reduces to the Poincaré group. Now, I can take the quotient of this group by its Lorentz subgroup. In this case, it's Lorentz sub-algebra. I don't know. This is usually how you reconstruct Minkowski space from Poincaré group. And if you see, the Lorentz op subalgebra is commutative, so the Lorentz part of the group is just classical. And what you get if you take this quotient is this, another op algebra, which is non-commutative. It's a generalization of the algebra of functions over Minkowski space, which is non-commutative. These can be interpreted as the commutation rules between coordinates of a non-commutative space. That's why this quantum group is thought to be related to non-commutative geometry. Now, op algebras are self-dual structures. That's an interesting thing. And since the Lie algebra, in this case, with algebra, if you take the algebra of functions over a group, you can reconstruct the Lie algebra related to the group, taking its dual, and you get the universal enveloping algebra of the Lie algebra. If you're in the op algebra case, interestingly, you get another op algebra if you dualize. There are self-dual structures. That's why Majid proposed op algebras as a realization. The way to realize the Born reciprocity in quantum gravity. Now, in the Lie algebra case, if G was a Lie group, I take the dual, and the Lie op algebra looks like this. From the commutative product, I get a primitive coproduct for the generators of the algebra. This means that they are derivative operators for the algebra of functions here, so they satisfy Leibniz's rule. Commutators come from the coproduct of the group, which codifies the group law, and that makes sense, of course. And the antipodes are just minus the generators, and the co-unit is just zero over the generators. I can do this for Kappa Poincaré, and what I get is this Kappa Poincaré op algebra, which is the main object I will consider in this part of my talk. The algebra is generalized to an enveloping algebra, so it has nonlinear structure here in the commutators, still governed by kappa. When kappa goes to zero, it reduces to Poincaré algebra. And there are novelties also in the coproduct. They don't satisfy Leibniz rule, and in the antipodes. Now, one motivation for me for studying this op algebra, the main motivation, could be this. It's that as Laurent Fredel and Itera Levin showed, in quantum gravity in 2+1 dimensions, where it is quantizable, if you couple quantum gravity with matter, and then you integrate out the gravitational degrees of freedom, what you get is something that can be related to an effective action for this matter, which is a non-commutative field theory. And this field here live in the algebra of Kappa Minkowski, so in this non-commutative space, and they are invariant under the Kappa Poincaré algebra. So maybe this Kappa Poincaré is like the no gravity limit of quantum gravity. If this could be generalized to 3+1 dimension, it would be something very powerful. So it is an indication for in favor of this model. Now, with Julia, we started from this to connect quantum groups with the relative locality. This is the momentum subalgebra of Kappa Poincaré. It is commutative, so it can be interpreted as the algebra of functions of a classical space-time, a classical space. We interpret this space as the momentum space of a relative locality theory. And we have a dictionary to translate all of the structures of algebras to the structures, the geometric structures of momentum space. EMP are the generators of an enveloping algebra, are coordinate functions, I mean, this function over the momentum space, that if calculated over P, a point in momentum space, give its coordinate in a particular coordinate system. Now, enveloping algebras are, OCF algebras are invariant under nonlinear redefinition of the generators, and this corresponds to diffeomorphisms of momentum space, as they are the change of coordinates. Then the coproduct and antipode are very naturally identified. Well, they very naturally define a composition law of the kind I showed you before. So the coproduct of P is a function of 2 points in momentum space that is given by this, the coordinates of the point given by the composition of P and Q. And similarly for the antipode, which is minus P. It's nice also that the co-unit give us the coordinates of the origin, because that's it. Epsilon is a function that goes from the algebra to numbers. And if calculated on this basis here, on the generators, it gives you 0. This just tells you that the coordinates of the origin point in this coordinate system is 0. And if I change system, I give you the coordinates in the other system. And an important remark is that OCF algebras satisfy a co-associativity axiom. This is basically for how you express this axiom. If you apply this to the definition of the composition law given by the coproduct, it tells you that the composition law is associative. So no OCF algebra can describe a connection of momentum space that has curvature. They will be flat. If you want to generalize this to the non-flat case, you have to resort to maybe OCF algebroids in which the co-associativity axiom is relaxed, but I won't dwell much on this. Now, the first structure you want to find in this for defining a momentum space is the metric. We did it exploiting the Lorentz covariance of the model. We had these commutators between boosts and momenta, and we interpret them as infinitesimal Lorentz transformations. If you do this, you have two differential equations that have already been integrated in literature by Rossano, Bruno, and et al. And this is the solution. So these are the finite Lorentz transformations of momentum space for this model. And the metric of momentum space is the sitter. The quickest way to see that is this. You take the sitter metric in commoving coordinates, and you transform them with this transformation here, and you see that it's invariant. Now, this isn't much very justified, so I will give you a more constructive proof. Consider this coordinate transformation. This is something that transforms the algebra into the ordinary Poincaré algebra, in which the boosts act like in the commutative case. this, here you have to pay attention, this doesn't mean that Poincaré algebra is something like a nonlinear realization of the ordinary Poincaré algebra, because the coalgebra, there's no basis in which the coalgebra gets classical. The Leibniz rule is never recovered. So it's just, since we are in an envelopic algebra, it's not surprising that there is a complicated transformation that brings a commutator into the classical form. But with this coordinate transformation as a problem, it's not invertible. There are two possible ways of inverting it with this sign. And this means that in turn that the coalgebra won't close because you don't know what to put here, if the first or the second solution of the inverse. Now, you can solve this problem by adding a fourth, a third in this 1+1 dimensional case, a third generator to the algebra, which is still a function of E and P. And in this way, the transformation results invertible because you cover the first solution when eta 4 is positive, and you cover the second when eta 4 is negative. In this way, the coalgebra closes. But these four coordinates, new coordinates, of course, are not independent. They are three coordinates over a two-dimensional space. And they, of course, they satisfy an algebraic relation. This is the relation. It's just a definition of the sister space in embedding coordinates. So that, to me, is the proof that the metric is the one of the sister. Now, with these coordinates, it's an easy game to find what we need, that are geodesics in momentum space, and the dispersion curves, which are, as I told you, the curves at constant geodesic distance from the origin. So geodesics in these coordinates are given by the intersections between, well, geodesic passing through the origin. They're given by the intersection between the sitter space and the planes that contain the eta 4 axis. And dispersion curves are given by the intersection with the planes orthogonal to eta 4. It's as simple as it can be. So if with a short calculation, you can show that the relation between the geodesic distance from the origin and the eta 4 value of the orthogonal plane is this. And making the coordinate transformation to the original coordinates, which I will call at this point commoving coordinates, will give you the dispersion relation in commoving coordinates. And for free, we got that when P is zero, E equals the mass. So the mass is interpreted as the rest energy in these coordinates. It could have depended on kappa, as in this coordinate happens. So this is something interesting. Then the next step is naturally to find out the connection, starting from this composition law, which was obtained from the coproduct. Now, the law I gave you before regards only the connection at the origin. It allows you to calculate the connection, the value of the connection at the origin, but we want the connection at every point. There is another law for this, which is like a translation of this law by k, and it gives you the value of the connection at k. If you calculate this for kappa Poincaré, you get this, a connection which is constant everywhere and has only one non-zero value, 40. Then, this connection is torsionful because it's not symmetric, and it has no metricity. If you calculate that with these coordinates with the metric in commoving coordinate, you get this. And as I said, it's flat because the law is associative. Now, I'm interested into the way in which the relativity principle is realized in this theory. As there is apparently Lorentz, there are Lorentz transformations on this momentum space, so hopefully this leads to a theory which is Lorentz invariant. The Lorentz transformations are this, I already showed you them. And it's obvious that they keep the dispersion relation invariant as they keep the metric invariant. The question is, do they leave the composition law invariant? That's not that's not to be taken for granted. And in fact, in the original paper on relative locality, it is said that Lorentz invariants should be implemented by a law that leaves the dispersion relation invariant, and also is an homomorphism for the composition law. In this way, it's easy to see that in the action, whatever composition of momenta you have in the conservation laws, it will always be invariant under this transformation. But this is not the case for Kappa Minkowski. This doesn't work. This doesn't hold simply. Now, this is due to a subtle issue, the fact that the coproduct of the boost generators contain momenta. This has been called by mathematicians a coaction of the momenta subalgebra on the Lorentz algebra. Now, Majid exponentialized this coaction to get an action or right action of the momentum sector on finite boosts. If I parameterize boosts by their rapidity, which coordinates the Lorentz group, I get this relation. This was calculated by Majid. So it's an action of p of a momentum of the rapidity. In our paper, we use this relation to show that there is indeed a way, a sense in which the composition law is invariant. But the subtle thing is that different momenta, when they are composed, will transform with different rapidities. You see that the law is this. If I transform with the rapidity xi, p o plus q, p transform with xi, but q transform with this xi, which depends on the moment on the left. The law is this. Now, this right action satisfies some compatibility relations with the composition law. And in particular, this, which is implied by the associativity of the composition law. So two subsequent right actions are equal to the right action of the composed momenta. And there is a relation between the inverse, or the antipode, and the right action. With these two, I can always express in a system of composed momenta everything in terms of the rapidity of one of the momenta at my choice. In this case, I can express it in terms of the rapidity with which Q transforms, while here I express everything with the rapidity of P and P plus Q. That is enough to ensure the Lorentz covariance of the theory. Every single vertex that I can write would be an invariant part of the action under these transformations. Finally, concluding this part, I have a remark. You have to be careful, because the Lorentz transformations and the back reaction of the momenta that I showed you are singular. Majid noticed that in his paper. For example, when you are outside of the upper light cone, when you're here, there is always a finite boost which makes the momentum diverge. And conversely, when you are for any given rapidity, there will always be a critical curve of momentum space outside of the upper light cone, where the right action diverges. Now, this worried Majid, but with our geometrical understanding of the meaning of this, it's clear that it's not a problem. It's just a coordinate artifact. In fact, we express all of our laws in comoving coordinates. It is well known that comoving coordinates don't cover all of the Sitter space, only half of it. And in particular, they have a coordinate singularity here and here, on these lines. This is an artifact of the coordinates. It's just if you transform from the embedding coordinates to these coordinates, here the transformation is singular. Now, since the Lorentz transformation sends dispersion curves to themselves, and so move points on dispersion curves, if I'm outside of the upper light cone, I will always have a finite rapidity, a finite boost, which will make me hit the critical curve, the coordinate singularity. So if I expressed everything, all my laws, in embedding coordinates, I wouldn't have had this problem. So this isn't a problem anymore. Now, this is a good point to ask you if you have any question, because if I have enough time, I will devote like a bunch of slides on a work in progress. 15. So if you have any question about the this particular work, I will switch to another newer work, which is in progress, but it's related to this, in particular to Lorentz invariants. So, shall I move on? This work is in collaboration with the people in Zaragoza, José Manuel Carmona and José Luis Cortés. It was inspired by a paper by Emilino Camelia, who asked himself which momentum spaces are Lorentz invariant, possess Lorentz symmetry. He introduced two things that he called golden rules, which are physical requests on the model. He asked the model to not to allow in vacuo photon decays and the presence of the switch-off threshold for photoproduction. Let me explain. This guy here is, of course, the process of a photon decay into a pair in vacuum without any other particle conserving momentum. Now, in Lorentz breaking models, it is normal to have such processes. Often it happens that such processes are allowed, and there are thresholds for this process to happen. Now, this is incompatible with the equivalence between inertial observers, because if there was equivalence, then I would have an inertial observer who measures the energy of this photon as being above the threshold, for example, so that the process is allowed. Another observer would measure this energy to be below the threshold, and therefore the process would be simultaneously allowed and not allowed. So that's against the relativity principle. In the same way, in this process, two photons, in which a hard photon hits a soft photon, producing a pair. This is a process that is allowed in special relativity, and there is a threshold, which is perfectly compatible with the relativity principle. So for every energy of the soft photon, I have a sufficiently high energy of the hard photon to produce a pair. But what happens is that in Lorentz breaking models, often I have another threshold at much higher energies, which depend on Planck mass, typically, for which the process is again forbidden. That is incompatible with the relativity principle in the same way as in vacuum photon decays. Now, Amelio Camelia considered a simple model, which is not the most general, but it's illustrative. And he worked first order in the inverse Planck mass. And he wrote down the most general dispersion relation, and not the most general, an example of dispersion relation and composition law, which depend on six dimensionless parameters. Now, he studied the kinematics of these two processes, the two golden rules, and he found that if you want them both to be prohibited, you have to enforce this constraint between the dimensionless parameters. And moreover, he also conjectured that the constraint is a necessary, of course it's necessary, because if it's not enforced, you have in vacuo photon decay, but also sufficient condition for a momentum space to be Lorentz invariant. Now, what we did, and we are still finishing in Zaragoza, is to study the problem in full generality at first order in Planck mass with the assumption that all the relations are polynomial in the momenta, and also that this is 1+1 dimensions, but we did it in 3+1, and we also asked a underformed rotational invariance in the 3+1 dimensional case. And this is the most general thing that you can write, depends on a bunch of dimensionless parameters. And what we did wasn't to enforce some golden rules or some physical conditions on the model. We asked the model to have a Lorentz symmetry, to have a Lorentz transformation. So we wrote the most general, again, Lorentz transformation. This is the infinitesimal version, which depends on three parameters. And inspired by the results of my paper with Julia, which showed that there can be a back reaction of momenta on Lorentz transformations, I wrote also the most general back reaction in the action of the Lorentz transformation of the composition of the momenta. Then we ask for three consistency conditions to be satisfied. Of course, the dispersion relation has to be invariant. Moreover, in the t plus one dimensional case, we ask the infinitesimal boost to close the Lorentz algebra so that a group is realized. They close the Lorentz group in the finite case. And moreover, we ask the invariance of the composition law so that this relation is satisfied. This implies a set of constraints. You start from 19 parameters, alpha, beta, gamma, lambda, and meta, and you have 13 relations, that reduce the degrees of freedom from 19 to 6. And it's quite natural to express everything in terms of lambda and eta, because there are 7 lambda and eta, but lambda satisfy this constraint, so there are 6 independent lambda and eta. So you can express everything in terms of the properties of Lorentz transformations, their form on single particles and their back reaction. Now, it's nice that in this case, whatever the process we choose to test this model, if the process requires a preferred frame or breaks Lorentz breaks the relativity principle, it will be forbidden. We tested this with the two golden rules of Amelie Mocamelia, and they are automatically satisfied. So you can't have Ibaco-Fotum decays and no switch-off threshold if the, this 13 constraint that I showed you are satisfied. Moreover, we also scrutinized the conjecture by Amelie Mocamelia that this constraint was sufficient. And we found that it is not. That is, this means that there are choices of the 19 parameters here that satisfy its golden rules, but don't lead to a relativistic theory in the sense that they don't satisfy our constraints. So they are stronger. This can be easily seen in the simple case considered by Emilio Gamelia, which corresponds to our choice, a choice of our parameters, eta 2 and eta 4 equals 0. So if you impose Amelie-Mocamelia's golden rule, you find that our constraints are not satisfied unless beta 2 equals minus alpha 2. This looks like something that can be enforced with another golden rule. And our conjecture is that maybe there is a finite number of golden rules, that is, of processes that have to be forbidden, that will fix all of our constraints and lead to a relativistic theory. But that's something that we could improve. So that's the status of this paper. We are on our way to posting it soon. Now, conclusions and some remarks. First of all, again, why should we care about this theory? For me, the main reason is phenomenology, because they are already bounding it. And they're bounding the Planck mass. So it's basically the only experimental bound that we have on something that involves the Planck mass. Then, I showed you that quantum groups fit very naturally into the relative locality scheme, but you could ask where did non-commutative space end, because quantum groups were meant to describe their symmetries. Now, as a, you can notice that, for example, the Kappa Poincaré quantum groups can be written with or without H bar. It is the same group. The only thing that changes is that it's that if you you can attribute the H bar to the commutators or to the left right hand side of the commutation relation, so you can substitute Poincaré Poisson brackets with commutators and put H bar on these relations. It's the same group, so it survives the classical limit, the H bar goes to zero limit. The idea is that maybe if you turn H bar on, you should recover a non-commutative space in these models. This is an inspiration to I don't know, to explore this direction. I would propose, for example, to make a path integral quantization of these relative locality models. We have an action. We have a way to combine vertices and to calculate the action over any arbitrary network. And so you can path integrate that. Maybe this turned out to be related, it's a conjecture, with the non-commutative field theory and so on. That's something to explore. Then, again, another thing that we did more. Okay. In our paper with Julia and also the other, we showed that Lorentz transformations are not, are by no means trivial in relative locality. There is this strange thing of having to transform different momenta with different rapidities. And so, to me, it's a direction that has to be explored as much as translational invariance. And moreover, I have a particular interest in Lorentz invariant models, because if you break Lorentz invariants, there is a lot of bounds on breakdown of Lorentz invariants that comes from the most diverse sources, like atomic clock comparison tests, ultra-energy astroparticles, and synchrotron radiation, and so on. But if you, you're speaking about Lorentz invariant models, basically there is only gamma ray bursts, with the possible notable exception of atom interferometry at this point, which in my PRL I showed that could reach Planck scale sensitivity, but this is still not clear. They're not bounding anything now with this model, with these experiments. And then I also studied the most general Lorentz invariant case for this reason, because I want, and now I have a six-parameter family of models that could be used to do phenomenology, and that's something that I would explore in the future. And that's it.
If you studied the most general Lorentz invariant case, do you know the answer to the question of whether there could be a model with the connection having curvature and momentum space, which is also Lorentz invariant?
The question of a model in which connection.
So in the Kappa-Planck arrays, you showed the curvature vanishes.
Mm-hmm.
Naively, it just if you play around and try to turn on the curvature, it seems often to break Lorentz invariants. Is there a way to have a model with has Lorentz invariants and also has curvature?
When I speak about the most general model, I speak about these first order implant mass toy models. In that case, the curvature can be present. No, because I assume that again, that's right. That's a limitation, not the model. I assume the associative. So that's another generalization of what. It has to be explored. I don't have the answer to this question. So, again, this could break Lorentz invariants all the time, so we could not actually explore that.
Maybe you look at, you haven't finished this problem, you have to look at also, you say there are six independent parameters, but I would imagine that lots of them are related by default transformation, first order default transformation. Where you should label this possibility by the torsion and monotricity,
mm-hmm.
and see at the end of the day.
Yeah, torsion and monotricity are tensors, so they should label. They should be.
The thing is that
they are the only tensors that could label the diffeo classes of these models.
Yeah, so you want to label the diffeo classes,
yeah.
and see whether Kappa Poincaré is the only option. What are we doing?
Because the
diffeo will not change its property. So you want to.
I think yes, the
you have six parameters for diffeo, it means two. Okay. So you should have done for two independent families and one interesting to classify.
So Kappa Poincaré should be one of them. And then, of course, then at second order in Planck mass, I had much more parameters, and again, much more constraints.
Yeah.
So, and we didn't look at that, of course. But well, the interest is, I don't know why, I should do that right now. Anyway, at first order, I expect one cup of one carat to be one half of the. Of the model as well.
And you can have Kappa Poincaré in time or Kappa Poincaré in space. So it gives you two families. The question is whether you
have. Maybe we have a theorem. Yeah, I expect also it to be. Yeah, in 1 plus 1, there should be the. And they shouldn't be related by diffeos, of course. So, yes. Maybe it's the only. You should check.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on opera now?
What?
What are your thoughts on opera?
On opera?
Yeah.
Well, the relation with this is the opera with Renato Boccaccio would require a deformation scale much smaller than the black mass. So the relation with this is not that clear. Opera is a very interesting result. It survived also the first check they did. I would say that there is nothing to be excited about until they repeat the experiment in another laboratory. And there have been this paper by Cohen and Glasshow claiming that it's excluded because of Cherenkov radiation by neutrinos. And the paper about that, and this is just, it is well known that if you break Lorentz symmetry, you have Cherenkov radiation, and that can be. But they totally ignored the issue of Lorentz invariant models with faster than light propagation, which is exactly what we have here. And this, to me, is the only the only window I see to explain this at the moment. And they ignored it, so I would say that I wouldn't exclude this experiment as they did. But of course, I wouldn't go as far as explaining it with relative locality at this point. Of course, it would require much stronger effects than they are expected. That's it.
Don't have more questions, we should.